What's up, homies? Logan Crowell here, founder of Home, helping our music evolve, Nashville's premier music hub. In this episode of the Homie Podcast, we're bringing Heather Cook on the show. She's an incredible figure here in Nashville in the world of sync and artist development, formerly with Pure Music, which is the largest independent music publisher in the world. She struck out on her own as the founder of Freedom Music Group. So not only is she pitching for sync and landing syncs for lots of amazing artists, she herself is starting to write and record. She's an amazing songwriter and artist herself. And it's just really cool to watch her do her thing on both sides of the window, as they say. If you're into sync and artist development and the intersection between the music and the business side, then this is going to be a really amazing episode for you. So tune in, check it out, and be sure to share it with a homie. Peace.
You're listening to Helping Our Music Industry Evolve, aka the Homie Podcast, where we bridge the gap between the traditional music industry and the new creator economy. I'm your host, Logan Crowell, serial entrepreneur and marketing nerd on a mission to empower music creators. Join me on this journey so that you don't get left behind in the new paradigm, and I'll show you why there's never been a better time to be in the music business. And now, let's dive in.
All right, Heather Cook, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The Homie Podcast. You're now officially a homie.
All right.
So you are helping our music industry evolve. That is the acronym that we kind of push forward with the Homie, you know, brand. And, you know, I particularly wanted to bring you on because of the way that you're helping the music industry evolve, not only as someone who's helping creators actually monetize their music in a life-changing way, but also, you know, fully entrenched in the creative side yourself and in making records for your own brand, making records, you know, for your catalog, which is, you know, pretty cool. So just real quick, want to give you a little bit more of an introduction before we dive into your story. So you are the founder and CEO at Freedom Music Group.
Yeah, that's right.
And you have a pretty deep background in sync, working for companies like Pure Music Group for quite a while, right?
Almost 10 years. It was like 9 years, 8 months or something.
Yeah, and Pure is the largest independent music publishing company in the world,
yes.
Correct?
Yes, so I had the opportunity there to work with some incredible catalog, just like legacy catalog, evergreen songs. It was really amazing.
Yeah, so I'm excited to dive into that too. and then, you know, just kind of understand a little bit more about what you're doing now versus what you were doing when you first kind of got into the sync game, how that's changed, how the industry has evolved as you've gone along in that role. And then, you know, just basically bring us up to speed on forming your own company, kind of what's going on now, and actually being able to bring your own creativity as an artist back into the flow, into the spotlight, if you will. So
it's
I'd love to hear about it.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about it. Yeah.
Cool.
So
let's go.
Cool.
So start us, you know, when we first met, what really kind of made me go, wow, this is an interesting story, was this specific instance where someone told you, hey, now that you have an industry job, you got to leave all that on the sidelines. You got to leave your own creativity behind.
Yeah.
And, you know, that happens naturally for people, but it was actually the first time I'd heard somebody like outright, you know, was told that, you know, it's kind of an explicit sort of command. So start us there and kind of bring us up to speed.
Sure. Yeah. So I started playing music and writing music when I was really young. So that was always there. Like, I always wanted to be a songwriter. So like from the time I was 8, 9 years old, although I didn't know it at that time, I just was writing songs. And so early 20s, I was trying to be that artist. And that was about 20 years ago. And that was a whole different music industry. So I was, you know, part of the time where we were ripping songs off the internet before.
Oh, yeah.
They had iTunes. That wasn't a thing yet. There was no social media. That was a whole different world. And so the producer I was working with at that time, he was doing reel to reel, like in the studio. And, you know, so I had this foundation. And from that time, I had some guys in the studio with me, like Denny Diaz from Steely Dan, or Dickie Dawson, who was a road warrior with Fleetwood Mac and the Byrds. And then Denny was interested in my writing. He wasn't in the studio, but he was interested in my songs. And so that kind of started that fire of like, oh my God, I'm a songwriter. Like, I need to do this and figure it out. But at that time, I couldn't really figure it out enough to where I was going to propel myself in that part of the business at that time in my career. And I remember somebody telling me to get an attorney. And I was living in Boston and I was working on Mass Ave right across the street from Berkeley. And I couldn't afford to get into Berkeley back then. So I was like getting the books at the Berkeley bookstore and like studying everything I could about copyright law and like songwriting and everything. And so, you know, fast forward, I had got down here to Nashville and got into the music business program at Belmont. And I was an adult student. So I was already like behind the eight ball, but I wasn't just like in my head, like the dean of schools told me I was at Belmont.
I did the same program, by the way.
Did you?
The adult degree program.
Adult degree program. Mm-hmm. And I tailored it like the music business program. And so I was older. I was like 26 when I got in. And while I was there, a lot of the students looked at me like big sister. And so I would help them. And I'm just, I'm a believer in like being of service. And so I was helping them. And so that's where my first company got started. I was a senior at Belmont University and I started my little baby company called Coconut Music Publishing and Artist Management. And, you know, that's where I got started. And I was pitching for artist, country artist on the row. And I had songwriters whose songs, like they were friends of mine, you know? But I had interned at publishing companies, so I kind of knew that world already. And I started pitching to my intern bosses and then people I met through networking. And I knew instinctively, but also what everybody had told me, go network, go meet with people. And I would take people out to coffee. I would take them to lunch and I would just ask them, like, how did you get in the business? I would love to know how you got in the business. And I found my way in. And you know, quickly, the sync thing started to pop up pretty fast because a lot of indie artists wanted that at that time, or they were at least exploring that. And so I had an artist named Emily Reed I was managing, and we had a hybrid kind of relationship. It was like, it was management, maybe consultant more than anything, helping her with her project, and got an opportunity with Disney and landed her a Disney placement. And that was like the first thing. It was like, oh my God, this is so fun. That was a song called Two in a Million, and it was in the season finale of Austin and Ally.
Cool.
And so like that began, and Pure came along pretty quickly.
Bit by the music money bug.
The music money bug, yeah, the sync music money bug.
Right, a little quicker turnaround than
Now, interestingly enough, that was work for hire. That didn't pay a big sync fee, but it was the opportunity. It was a great, look for the artist, and so, you know, was the music supervisor, great music supervisor on that, Steven Vincent at Disney. He's still there. And yeah, so that's kind of the foundation.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Of all of that.
And then what happened, you know, whenever you joined a bigger company, you were told that you don't need to be making music anymore. And
so
you got to focus on...
Well, and that started before that. That started when I started my company. So I had some mentors in the business. I had a consultant or two I had hired just to give me guidance and help me as I was trying to break into the business. And it was through those conversations as I was starting my first business that they were like, you know, and it wasn't just them. It was everybody in the business. Anybody you talk to behind the scenes, what they're saying is if you're an artist, you have to put it away because they won't even hire you. Like if you mention it in an interview, they wouldn't hire you. I do it. I mean, when I worked up here, if I get a resume for someone wanting to be an intern, I was vetting them to see, like, are you coming in here because you want me to sign you? And not, yeah. like, that's an awkward situation, understandably.
Sure. Yeah.
So there is a reason for that. There's a professional, ethical reason why those two things you have to be careful. And when, you know, depending on what direction and one place you start in the business. And so where I started, it made sense at that time to put that aside. And truly, like, I didn't have anything to speak for. Like, I don't really like anything I did earlier in, you know, my 20s. It's like, it was fine, but I hadn't figured my sound out yet, mm-hmm. and I didn't have anything I was excited about. So I was fine with it. I was like, yeah, I need to put that aside for a minute. Timing is everything. The time wasn't right for that then. And the time became right later. And most recently in the last 2-3 years that felt like the right time to do that. So I think while the advice at the time was, congruent with what the entire industry felt and was doing. And now I think that has shifted a little bit. The woman that runs Head Bitch Music, she's amazing and she's a wildly talented artist and she runs her own company and I admire her so much. There's other folks like out there.
Craig
like
Wiseman, yeah. you know, starting Big Loud. Right?
Yes.
So it's like,
yeah. Liz Rose, she's a songwriter and a publisher. You know, mm-hmm. there's so many great examples of that now. Mm-hmm. And they paved the way, I think. And so I think I finally just, for me, I just got to a place, you know, I'd been at Pure Music for a long time. I learned so much at Pure. And Craig Currier, I constantly say it, he was my greatest mentor in learning about this world because he's literally the OG of Sync. Like he knows, he's done it for a while and he does it really well. And so it's kind of, when you are a creative, it's kind of hard to be in those situations where you're learning and you're teaching the other folks to do it. And then for you to not have that seep in somewhere, like that's what happened for me. And it came out all of a sudden. It was like, all of a sudden I was writing songs and Jasmine Ash is my friend who she was writing for me at Pure and she pulled me out of the writer closet. She was like, come on, you gotta write again. Come on. You know,
how long ago was this?
That, let's see, I'd been at Pure for like 8 years at that point. Yeah, so she was like, come on, just do it, try it. Don't be afraid, we'll figure it out. And so I was still quietly doing it in the background.
Okay.
But Pure didn't hire me for that. That wasn't my purpose there. So it made sense for me to go on somewhere else. And that's why I left, I went to Eternal Music Group. And I always say, Pure were my teachers, Eternal were my champions, and they both gave me wings to fly. And so, Maura Duval Griffin and Todrick Spalding, they were my bosses at Eternal. And when I had an interview with them, I said, I'm writing music again. I'm exploring this. I don't know where it's going to go. And they were like, oh my God, yes, we'll support you. We'll help you release songs. I was like, oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, and these are music supervisors.
Yeah.
You know, in that world, there's a lot of folks that have always done that. Mm-hmm. Both. Like they're both a supervisor. They're running a company and they're doing music because that's a part of their who they are. Mm-hmm. And so they just, you know, they just got it right away. They're like, yeah, do that.
Yeah.
Do that. So yeah. And it was during my time at Eternal that I wrote my first single, Supernatural. I wrote that with a producer, Elia X, who's amazing. And I brought in a hip hop artist I worked with for a long time, Julissa. And Georgia actually had the track already. And here's where the shift happened, where I was like, okay, now I'm excited about the sound, the music, and mm-hmm. the vision of what it could be. She had this rock track. She's like, you're a rock artist. Nobody had ever said that to me before. And I've been trying to figure it out forever. And I did the hook in the track. She's like, sing it like this. And I did it. It took like 15, 20 minutes.
Who was this coaching you?
This was Elia X who was guiding me in this session and with this track for that song. And took me just a little, it just was fast. Got it done. And it was awesome. I was hyped about it. I'm like, I got a hip hop artist. We got to get on these verses. I co-write with the artist on the verses. And we had the song. And then now it was licensed by Athletes Unlimited for all the promos for their basketball season. They made it their song of the season.
Wow.
It's currently playing in like over 20 sports arenas around the country, including the LA Lakers and Dallas Mavericks.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God, I should have done this sooner.
Yeah.
You know?
That's some good affirmation kind of out of the gate, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Feels good. Yeah.
Exciting. So people like yourself have, you know, ultimately become the sort of artist development support system, I think, for a lot of artists now that labels aren't really doing development, or not most of them aren't doing development. And the ones that don't fit into the sort of traditional publishing, you know, machine or what have you.
Yeah.
A lot of them end up over in this world of sync, making music, you know. And I would love for you to talk about just, you know, your approach to artist development, and then how you stay balanced between developing your own project and also helping everybody else developing, you know, develop their project as well.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite places to live in, because it's exciting. Like, it's, you know, when I meet a new artist and I'm excited about their sound, like, I just want to see them thrive and succeed. Awesome. And like, anything I can do to help them in that way. Like, it all comes back to, I just want to be of service. Like, that's a huge mantra in my life, is how can I be of service in any situation? And so, I mean, it started so long ago, and I, you know, when I come at helping an artist and developing them, the first thing I want to know is who they are. Like, who are they really? And what do they really want? And what is their real sound? Because so often artists are chasing something they think they should be.
Status.
And right? Yeah, because they'll think like, oh, I need to sound like this because the radio sounds like this. I need to sound like this because that's what is in Grey's Anatomy, or, you know, Emily in Paris, or whatever. You know, they think they have to fit a particular mold. And so I'm often like, no, no, come back to who you are. Start there, and then create a song. Then write a song from that position, because you're going to be way more successful from that authentic place. And it's a thing we hear in sync all the time. Be authentic. You know, media asks for music that doesn't exist. You know, they ask for songs that artists don't typically write. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not writing songs about, let's get together and have a good time. Like, that's just not what they're writing, you know? Yeah. So there is a certain amount of, they have to create something bespoke or like specific to a brief, but they have to do it in such a special way that it is very true to their voice and their sound. And it's in a way that they would say it. And so I have a lot of conversations about that. I have a lot of conversations with artists about believing in themselves. I know it for myself. Like, I mean, clearly, because it took me 20 years to get to this place where I'm like, okay, I'm ready to release music, and feel confident in that. And so many artists really struggle thinking they're good enough and really believing in themselves. And it's often like coaching and counseling, you know, and like being a cheerleader for them. And
a lot of mindset.
Yeah. Mindset stuff.
What I have noticed, comes, you know, it basically starts with a tactical question, and then you kind of uncover a sort of strategic challenge, but then you go a little deeper and it's like, really, you know what to do, don't you? And and you know what you're struggling with is, you know, what's really expected of you to perform at that level, and you know, to keep it up, to be vulnerable enough to really you know, be your authentic self, you know, not hide behind a persona or a brand or something, right?
And it's also balanced with knowing when to take that advice or listen to somebody who is seasoned in the business that's giving you like a reflection, or like, you know, here's how I see it, I would encourage you to think about this. I've had to do that many times. And it's a balancing act, and it's knowing and trusting your gut. It's also being honest, you know, honestly with myself as an artist. There are songs that I've made that are not good. I would never let anyone listen to them. I have to be really honest with myself about that. You know, I have to be very critical of myself. And I've sought guidance from other people. I have my own mentors still now, who I say, all right, here's what I'm thinking. This is what it sounds like. Voice coaches, you know, just branding coaches, like all just different people.
Yeah, good.
And I'm sure people are hearing this are like, how much is that costing you? I trade. I do a lot of trade. Tabitha Meeks is this artist that I manage, and I have for a while. And she and I started writing together initially. And it evolved into her asking me to manage her. So Tabitha Meeks is an artist I manage, and we first met writing together. We met at a funeral initially, and then we started to write together. And in that, I wanted to learn more piano, and she wanted to learn more sync. And so we traded. And nice. She taught me piano, I taught her sync, and then that relationship just kept evolving. Nice. And so I do that a lot. And so with the various mentors I've sought out, there's been trade situations there, or when I've been able to save a little bit of money and have that, I can spend that money strategically. Mm-hmm. That's really been important. So when it comes to developing artists, every artist is different. You know, it's not a cookie cutter stamped out, here's what I do for everybody exactly. Some people need more encouragement. I hear from some of my artists more regularly than others. I have a handful that call me or text me regularly, and they'll say, hey, can you talk right now? Sometimes they just want to get on the phone and talk. Mm-hmm. And it's that. And for me as an artist, once Elia X helped me, and that's Georgia Edgeworth, when Georgia helped me get to that place of knowing, okay, this is my North Star now. I brought that North Star song to my mentors and I said, here it is. This is what I need to do. And then we talked through, what does that look like? And so as a female rock artist who's doing like anthemic sports songs, mm-hmm. I just, you know, I've been figuring out, what does that look like? You know, kind of what is my image? What is my brand? Mm-hmm. Getting feedback from other people, listening to what people are saying online. And so I'm still figuring, that's still evolving. So the look and the feel and the brand is going to continue to evolve. It has to. But I am always open to hearing, listening, learning. And I encourage everyone to live in that space. Like, don't ever get married to a song so much that if somebody gave you feedback that you weren't like okay to take it, or at least take it in consideration, take it or leave it kind of thing. So
totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you say that you're teaching someone sync, can you kind of drill down into that for us? And if somebody didn't know sync, how would you start? You know, what would your approach be?
I mean, the first thing, if people are asking, I have a lot of people come to me, hey, I just want to learn about sync. I'm just getting started. Mm-hmm. I send them to my TikTok page because that's my sync learning plate space.
Right. Go ahead and shout that out.
Yeah. Heather D. Cook, or Heather Cook on TikTok. I can't remember my handle there, honestly. if you go to my website, heatherdcook.com, you'll see my ecosystem of everything I do. Cool. And so I've done a lot of videos there where I'm touching on all the different aspects of sync and how it works, everything from song structure and licensing and relationships and how to pitch, how not to pitch. Then I've also written an ebook. So I have an ebook on that same website I mentioned, heatherdcook.com. And it's just a quick read, but it's just kind of a simple, you know, foundation of some of the sync things to know. I outline what a brief might look like. I outline just kind of the thought process. And this one's specifically geared towards advertising because that's where I worked in peer music. I was in the sync ad department. And so I was working with all ad agencies and brands. And so and from there, you know, once they've gotten the basics, there's another book I always recommend, Amanda Creek Thomas's book on sync. It's like a sync 101 book. Highly recommend everybody read that. And then I say, all right, I'll talk to you and like, let's sit down.
Yeah.
Some folks hire me as a consultant. And so if you want to hire me as a consultant, because my roster's full and I'm not taking anyone else on. And so the way you can get me is to like sign up for some time because my time is very, very limited.
Yeah.
And I'll guide artists in a session or multiple sessions, and we'll go through and break down, okay, well, what songs do you have? We'll go through the songs and I'll look at, okay, well, here's what's working, here's what's not working structurally on this song. I give them feedback about how to work in sessions, you know, how to work with a producer in those sessions. So important to get the kind of producers that understand this world. Mm-hmm. There's producers who don't work in this world and they don't produce in the right way and structure it properly. Yeah. They're writing for hits for the radio, mm-hmm. or a particular genre, and there's a particular way the songs are structured. And so sync has its own structure as well.
Cool. Do you want to throw out a couple of the sort of most common things that you see, like just a few practical tips, essentially, where you see people bringing you their music and it just doesn't work for sync for whatever reason?
Yeah.
Can you identify just maybe a few reasons why that is? And I think that'd be helpful for me, sir.
Yeah. I mean, people often think that songs that are for sync, they put it down here like it's not as an important song. And so they don't treat it the same way. They want a song, they might want to get a big hit from a big artist to recording it on the radio. You have to treat that song as if it's going to have millions of streams on Spotify, as if it's going to be number one in the charts. Like, it is a treat. It is a great song. You have to start with a great song first. I don't want sync songs. And so that's the first thing I tell people, like, well, this doesn't, you know, one thing, they could be completely off the grid and it's not even close to what I need. It's production wise is not strong enough. The vocals aren't strong enough. Work on your vocals. Like, if you don't already naturally have a really, really strong voice, voice lessons can help people take that to the next step in that next level. I always recommend Wendy Parr. I adore her.
Yeah,
I love her. She's amazing. And make sure the lyrics are right. You know, a lot of songs I ignore, I don't take in because they just don't fit my needs. There are a lot of sync rules, but there are a lot of sync rules that are broken all the time. You know, they'll say, don't send me love songs. Well, I just licensed like six songs over the last few months that are love songs for TV shows.
Nice.
So that's kind of out the
window.
All
the rules are made to be broken, right?
All rules are made to be broken. Don't send me Christmas songs. Send me songs that are about winter. Well, my Tabitha, she had a song called, you know, that's a, has the title Christmas, the song, you know, in the title. And that's licensed in a Hallmark movie, you know? Mm. So you just never know. And I believe there's a place for almost every song. It has to be really well produced, great vocal. It has to just be a really great song in order for it to work. Yeah. So
cool. Yeah. That's the classic advice that nobody wants to hear, yeah. Right? Start with an insanely good song and see how everything else just tends to work out from that point.
And I'm amazed at how casual people are with their craft. Like, I've met some folks that are like, it's just kind of a hobby. I'm like, well, I'm not a hobby. I'm sorry.
We're doing this for real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. So what advice would you give to someone who doesn't really have a team right now, but they're looking to break into the sync world? They're looking to get on the radar of somebody like you.
Yeah. So I would say be your own team first. So it is the thing we hear from everybody around the business, you know, even record labels. They're not signing artists until the artist has shown they have the ability to do it on their own first and created a bunch of buzz on their own. And that's a scary thing. It's like, well, how do I do that? There are so many, there's so much education out there now that artists can learn. And you know, TikTok, there's a ton of stuff. Like, start reading and researching to understand how to run your own business. Because if you're an artist, you're a producer, you're a business. Mm. So you have to be the
I've
CEO.
Spent so much time talking about
the
this.
CFO, the CMO. You are the marketer, the financial person, the banker, the all the things.
The leader of your own business.
When
your own life.
I sign people because they are their own boss. Tabitha Meeks is a boss.
Nice.
I don't have to drag
you. You want to be around other bosses. You want to be around other bosses.
That's right.
Yeah, what do you know?
Yeah.
That's actually excellent
advice. I need to write a song about being a boss now. That's
excellent advice. You know, and just to like maybe riff off that for just a second, because, you know, there is a lot of ego in the music industry, right? And so I think there's a difference between like thinking you're a boss, you know, and then actually being a boss, like having, you've put in the work, you really have the chops, you're really good at managing your life, you're consistent, people can count on you to show up and kick ass every time, right? It's like the real confidence versus cockiness kind of thing, right? Where people you know, think that being a boss means they have to act some kind of way. No.
No. No.
No.
You know, I was just watching the Recording Academy has some educational things they're putting out, and I was watching the songwriters wing discussing this specific question that came up. And no one wants to work with somebody who's a jerk, mm-hmm. honestly. And we can all sniff out when someone's new and acting arrogant. Mm-hmm. It's super obvious. Yeah. So, like, don't even pretend because we already know.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody knows each other. So, like, this industry is small. The music industry is small, but the sync industry is even smaller.
Microcosm inside of that.
Yes. Yeah. Everybody knows each other, and we all talk. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we'll have conversations. Like, that person, I don't know about that. And so, yeah, you have to be, I mean, being loving and tolerant and kind, like, being honest, like, really having a principled life for me is so important.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, like, one of my mentors who I mentioned earlier, Craig Currier, he said it to me one time. He talked to me about humility because I got real cocky one time and I was like, look at me. And I was like doing the, you know, peacock strutting my tail feather. And he said, you know, it's okay to let other people toot your horn for you sometimes. You do not have to always toot your own horn. And it was really great advice.
So a lot of times I like to ask people, like, give me a day in the life, you know, of you and what you're doing. But because you're doing the creative and the business side, I would like to hear, like, what's a week in the life look like?
Yeah.
You know, have you been able to compartmentalize the hats that you're wearing? And,
yeah.
You know, like, how many writing sessions are you still able to squeeze in?
Yeah. So I am very structured about my life and everything. So I usually get up between 6 and 6:30 a.m. And my husband and I are getting the kids ready for school. And I do my workout in the morning. I have to do a workout every morning because if I don't, like, it feeds the creative energy.
Great.
And I meditate.
Listen up, everybody.
I meditate and I pray and I have just, like, beautiful. These core things I have to do every day. And then every day of the week has a specific purpose. So Monday and Fridays, I don't schedule any meetings because I have specific things I want to do on those 2 days. Monday, I get my week ready. And so my team, Jason Lee and Lainey Shorner are my other sync folks. Lainey's in Paris and Jason's in Los Angeles. And so I have a
great
nice
places
sync
for,
team.
Yeah, for your sync team to be.
Yeah. So Monday, Jason and I have a production meeting. And so we talk about all the music that's come in. We talk about any signings that we want to do or we're thinking about. We go through anything that's left over, and then I prep my marketing piece for the week. So I have every Tuesday I have a piece that I send out that's highlighting the catalog in a certain way.
Email.
Yeah, an email. So marketing email that goes out to all of our contacts. And I have an entire system in the background, which I don't want to give away too many secrets.
Yeah,
but
you don't
know,
have to.
I have a whole system.
More just the overarching sort of view of how you're able to productive and balance these things.
And my systems really help me with that. My being able to have a place where it's like, all right, here is what I'm doing with my marketing. Here's where my sales need to happen. We actually have a plan and goals that we set for the whole year and then back that down to, like, the quarter, the month, the week, the day.
Right.
So I know what I'm doing every day. And then I try to get one or two writes in a week. So this week I had two co-writes. So the first one I had was with Michael McQuaid, amazing rock artist, and Steve Vito. Steve's up in Connecticut, amazing producer, really gifted. And we wrote a really great song together, rock sports track, which we decided actually both Michael and I are going to record our own versions of and have a female and a male rock version of the song. And then yesterday I was writing with Tabitha and a producer named Joe Ginsberg. And Joe is signed to Ren Song Music Publishing, and I actually represent Ren Song. And quickly, the backstory there is that I was an intern at Ren Song 15 years ago. So Rigar has always been just amazing, and she's been asking me for a few years if I would rep her catalog, and so the time was right to do that. And that's been so much fun. But having those, that specific time that I can do all these things today, earlier today, I have our team meeting Friday mornings. We go over everything from the week. What do we accomplish? What do we need to change in our strategy to make sure we have music searches coming in? And so we're all very strategic about what we do. The reason that Jason and Lainey are on my team is because they think the same way as I do in that regard. And we work really well together that way. So we have a plan of attack. We do it, execute it, and then refine it every time. And so it has to be very purposeful for me to incorporate the creative, because it is a lot. There's a lot going on. And in addition to everything else, we recently started the Nashville and Sync Coalition.
Okay.
With a bunch of my sync friends in town. And we have our first event happening next month, which I have to mention.
Okay. Yeah.
If you go to nashvilleandsync.com. Right now it's membership only.
Are we hosting that? I think we're hosting
that. You are hosting that.
Yeah. Yes.
It is happening here at
it's
home.
It's happening here at home. So, yeah.
Which we're so excited about. Thank you.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it's, you know, it's for an organization for sync creative. So if you're representing a catalog, or if you're a licensor and you issue licenses and handle the payments and all of that, those folks can be members. And then we'll have public facing events too. But yeah, so I have to be very strategic with my time.
Yeah. How much are you pitching?
A lot. Yeah. I mean, it depends on the week. This week was slow. Last month, I think we worked on 30 or 40 different briefs, and across the board for film, TV, and advertising. We also had a sync camp last month. So we had 13 briefs we worked on for the camp. And I can't say it yet, but we have two songs up for a car commercial that I'm like, fingers crossed they land.
Yeah.
But just getting that quote and saying, okay, we like these two, you know, we'll let you know where it lands. I'm excited,
That's great.
I can't celebrate until I see it on the air, you know? So yeah, it's
part
busy.
Of your morning visualization and affirmation, right?
Yep. Yeah. Manifest that coming to life. Yeah.
So tell me about a time, you know, when something's come through that was like basically life changing for, you know, for somebody on the other side of it.
Yeah. Oh, there's been a few of those. There was one artist years ago when I was at Pier, and I can't remember exactly what the placement was. What I remembered was I went out with my boss and this artist, and he said, I quit my day job today or yesterday or whatever because of the placement you guys got.
Wow.
For me.
And you gotta love that.
That was awesome. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
You know? That was life changing. Yeah. When Stephen Vincent at Disney came up to me at the showcase at the film festival and said, I love Emily, I want her to write for Disney, changed my life. Mm-hmm. That was like, oh my gosh, what just happened? Yeah. Like, I think that just happened.
Wow.
Those are some special moments.
Yeah. That's awesome. So I'm sure, you know, especially at Pier, you said you're repping some catalogs now too.
Yeah.
And you were obviously doing all kinds of, you know, interesting artists and things at Pier. So do you have any kind of highlights of some of the stuff that you've been able to, you know, work or get placed, or anything kind of special stick out as like some legacy artists or?
Yeah. Oh yeah. There's a lot of fun stories. So at Pier, I got to work with Buddy Holly's catalog, or at least a portion of it. Buddy Holly started his career at Pier.
Wow. That was like his first publishing deal?
That was his first publishing deal. He met his wife, Marie, at the New York office at Pier, because she was a secretary at Pier in New York.
Wow.
And it's where he
met her.
That's
a good story.
It's really cool. And years later, Miss Pier, I think, sold part of the catalog back in the early 80s or something, which is like, oh my gosh. But I had landed every day in an IKEA commercial, and that was very cool. That was super fun. I'm like, oh my God, amazing. And that was kind of early years up here. And then a couple years after that, I did my genealogy, and I figured out Buddy Holly is a cousin, my cousin. Like, whoa. He's like my seventh cousin, but still, I was like, that's cool.
That's pretty interesting.
That's super random. Like, okay. So, that's just a funny, like, that's just random. And then while we were at, while I was at Pier, we had a secret deal that we were not at the time allowed to talk to anybody about. We couldn't even talk, promote it. We worked with Prince in the last 2 years of his life.
Wow.
And I think it's fine now to talk about it now that he's gone. That deal's gone now. So we were bound by NDA at that time. And so we had to promote his catalog without promoting it. And that was so challenging. Like, and we had to run everything by him first. So we couldn't pitch it unless he was okay with it.
Mm.
And so I had a meeting with Calvin Klein in New York. It was one of my New York trips that I did. And I had, I literally met with a couple of people from the marketing team, and I pitched the idea.
You're like, hey.
Prince.
And,
Prince, by the way. Yes. And I brought the idea to his team. It was the closest I got to, I never got to meet him. I was so bummed. I get to meet him or see him in concert. But I brought the idea to his team, and I said, here, I have this idea of, you know, because Prince was about being androgynous and Calvin Klein perfume is androgynous. Mm-hmm. It was like the perfect marriage of doing something together. And it's Prince. It's easy to start that conversation, you know, like I'm doing nothing, but just like, here's the idea. He said, yes, that's a great idea. Go ahead. And then I went to Calvin Klein and they loved the idea. And then it was not long after that he had passed away.
Oh.
And so it didn't happen, but I was, you know, learning how to work with artists of that caliber, that was pretty amazing. And there is a lot of confidentiality that comes into working with artists. And I still carry that with me. I always will. Every artist I work with, everything is confidential to the extent that they want me to keep it confidential. And that kind of understanding that, that's, you know, an important skill set to have when you work with legacy catalog. And there's been, you know, and there's been other fun ones that, so now I have a few cool catalogs I get to work with. Music and Media is one, and they have songs like Mambo Italiano and Werewolves of London. And they have the entire Funny Girl album with Barbara Streisand and songs like People and Don't Rain on My Parade. And you know, they have Young MC, and they have tons of songs from him that are just like unreleased or never been heard songs from him that are so much fun to pitch, and they cannot wait to land.
And it's got to be a different approach, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would think there's a little bit more sales finesse and creativity that comes into marketing a well-known catalog than going, hey, I'm going to rip all these indie artists, and when a brief comes through, we're gonna pitch for it and kind of cross our fingers.
Right.
You know, this is there's demand for these songs out there. It's just where's that at? Kind of question,
yeah, and
right?
It's balancing. It's basically reintroducing songs people hadn't thought about in a while, or ever thought about, and especially in advertising, the you know, folks are getting younger and younger, and they came from a generation who didn't even know that music. But for advertising, they have to market to different generations. So they have to kind of have an understanding of various types of music from different decades. And so letting them know, you know, either, you know, through the marketing pieces that I do, the conversations that I'm having, and like, oh, hey, have you heard what, you know, we've got young MC, and you should hear all this stuff. Like I just said, you know, I'm going to be their cheerleader just as much as I am the indie artist that I'm working with and developing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, really knowing the catalog, knowing the history of it, knowing that particular artist, knowing their particular nuances. Prince always said he was his own publisher, and he did not like anyone taking credit for his work. And so you had to be careful about what you said or how you promoted him and not take credit for it. And, you know, and so knowing who they are, whether they're alive, you know, they're alive or deceased, and really honoring those works, because they're special. You know, I got to work with Donovan too. Oh my gosh, Donovan, like he was friends with the Beatles. He taught John Lennon how to fingerpick guitar. Mm-hmm. He'd like, you know, Sunshine Superman and Catch the Wind, all these things that they had their own historic moments. He's lived a whole career. And getting back to the humble conversation, like, he's a humble guy. You know, there's no attitude. You know, we work with artists of that caliber and songwriters of that caliber. I received the best rejection letter from Bruce Springsteen's team.
Okay.
And so we had a brief that came in, was for a car commercial, and they referenced Bruce. And I was like bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, new in the business, like this side of the business, like brand new, like maybe been up here for maybe a year or two. And when they referenced Bruce, I asked them, well, why haven't you gone to Bruce? And of course, he didn't at that time want his music licensed. He was just not interested.
Purist, right?
Purist, total purist. Still, like I think the last holdout. Right. And so a friend of mine, her father worked with Prince early in his career. And so I had reached out to her and I just said, my friend Nicole Barcelona. And I said, you know, hey, I'm working on this brief and I'm wondering if Bruce would be interested if we represented a song, because I found out that he owned his own publishing at that time. It's before Sony bought him. And at first she said, oh no, he's not interested. I ran it by there to know they're not interested. And then she called me back and she said, actually, his right-hand person wants to talk to you. Yes, they're interested. So they had one of his people.
I bet you're freaking out a little bit.
Freaked out. Freaked out. One of his people called to talk to me about it. And then the lawyer called to talk to me about it. Wow. And the lawyer called me and said, you know, I'm calling you because no one ever gets this far in a conversation with Bruce. And I had put a whole presentation together. Like I had put a whole pitch together for him. And
nice.
I was like, you tell me what kind of commission you want to give us at all. Like, tell me the number. We will do it. You know, I was like 5%, 2%, 3%, flat fee. You tell me, like, I was willing to do anything to license a Bruce song. And we went the pace, like we really got there. And the music supervisor, I let him know, I called him and I said, hey, I think Bruce might be down for this. And he was like, you're kidding, right? No, that's not true. That can't be real. I'm like, no, for real. I'm telling you honestly and truthfully, yes, this is about to happen, possibly. And so we got the went the paces. The attorney called me. She's like, we're close. I'll let you know. She called me the next day. She said, I'm calling you personally to say I'm sending you this rejection letter, but I'm letting you know personally because no one gets that far. And she said, usually I just issue rejection letters. It was the most special moment in my career in sync. And it was a big sync fee.
I bet.
Massive. I'd never seen this kind of fee before, uh-huh. ever. And I still haven't seen that fee again. And so, I was like, I'm happy. I mean, just the fact that I got to be at the table at least.
Yeah.
But I learned a lot from that negotiation that I'll do differently next time. So finding ways to incorporate that in a meaningful way and then helping support the organizations that are working on laws that'll protect us. So I'm a professional member of the Recording Academy and we have Advocacy Week next week, October 1st. And so they've prepared us with a bunch of, you know, documents and information when we're talking about those things and how important it is and the laws that we want to have passed and talking to our legislators and sending a letter and leaning into those organizations like the NMPA is also doing the same thing. And NSAI, you know, they're all working really hard on the Hill to help protect creators. And so, you know, whether it's making a donation or calling your representative and letting them know the important laws that need to get passed to protect us. You know, that's important. And as we evolve, the industry has always been slow to evolve when it comes to technology. That is it's since, you know, we started this business,
yeah.
You know, they had the quarter that came out and then they had to figure out how to put the law around that thing, you know, iTunes came out. Okay, we need to figure out some different ways that we're handling that.
That's just now like kind of shaking out what that looks like, which is so crazy.
Yeah. So the industry is always going to evolve. I think at some point we'll get to a place where blockchain plays a really meaningful role in licensing and copyright royalties. Administration and royalties and I think there are companies out there that are starting to figure that out, or at least getting the basis of, I think that will probably be the next evolution that we'll see in the industry.
It could solve a huge problem if everybody would get on board on the same blockchain or whatever.
Right. I think the problem is now everyone's trying to create their own. And it's like, whose system are we tapping into here? Mm-hmm. Right.
Who's going to, how do we get everybody on the same one? Or, you know, there are what they call oracles that help the blockchains talk to each other and things like that. But then you still have to get to some sort of agreement of, you know, how those things are managed between different parties. And it's a mess. It's a messy industry, isn't it? It is.
Yeah.
It's so messy.
But I think we'll get there. You know, at BMI and ASCAP started a few years ago with Songview. Mm-hmm. You know, now their systems talk to each other. And
did not know that.
They're, yes, they are.
Welcome to the 21st.
So they're starting that blockchain system in some way. Good. So I think that'll continue to evolve.
Okay. That's great. Anything else that you would like to leave with the listeners? Any advice or any final thoughts just about your sort of purview of your part of the industry?
Yeah, I mean, be honest and true to yourself, and also be open to evolve. Mm. You know, when I look back at where I started 20 years ago trying to get into this business, I was a completely different person. Mm-hmm. And I have just constantly evolved. Mm. And I'm going to evolve again. I don't know where it's going to take me. But just being open to that evolution of creativity. I didn't think I'd be in my 40s releasing songs as a rock artist. Did not see that coming, nor did I plan for it. You know,
it's inspirational to me personally because, you know, I got into all this as a creator, and I'm one of those people too that, you know, I ended up kind of sacrificing my musical development so that I could help other people develop their music and their business. And as you were going through this sort of newfound sense of freedom, right?
Yes.
From starting your own company and getting, you know, back to your sort of creative endeavors, was there anything else going on in your life that, you know, may have kind of like influenced, you know, this new direction that you're taking?
Yeah, there was a number of things. I have degenerative disc disease and stenosis in my spine. And all this time that I've talked about over the last 15, 20 years, I've been living in chronic pain as a result of it. And so I've been battling that pain and had many back surgeries. And it came to a head about 2 years ago. My L4, L5, and my lowest part of my spine completely ruptured. And I was bedbound, and I had to be pushed in a wheelchair for about 2 months.
Wow.
2 months. And it was intense. It was pretty intense. And and living with that kind of pain, chronic pain every day. I mean, it was every day. And it's just low level hum that's always there. And you just don't notice it. And you don't realize your spine, it affects everything. And I didn't realize how much it was kind of keeping me down. And people wouldn't, you know, if they knew that, they were like, I didn't even notice. You know, I had friends that would say, you're always so up and happy all the time. Like, I didn't really realize you're going through that. Because I was always just trying to be okay. Like, you know, I got to push through and it's going to be right. And you just do this, you know, and I'm a mom and I've got little boys and I've got to be like there for them. And so, you know, I just pushed through that. And then when I had this major surgery at the Texas Back Institute, Dr. Blumenthal was my surgeon. And he did this pioneering surgery where they completely replaced both my discs and my back, and massive surgery. And it was the best way to describe it. It was like having a spiritual experience. It was like, it changed my life so significantly, like not physically being in pain. It was like breathing for the first time in 20 years.
Wow.
It was a tremendous kind of impact. And after that happened, I had been writing, but I really started writing after that. And like creatively, it was like the floodgates open. It was like, holy cow, where did this come from? It just been sitting in there for so long and just needed to come out. So yeah, that was pretty tremendous. And I had other things earlier in my life. You know, there's some trauma that I've had to do a lot of therapy to deal with. And I'm a survivor of domestic violence. I was in a really bad relationship in my early 20s. Wow. And my next single is coming out, you know, Fade to Black. I wrote that with Eric Campbell. That's about a little bit about that journey, you know, finding who I was and finding my power and my strength came at that time. And it's continued to evolve and grow. And so I'm often talking to people that have been through that about, you know, kind of how to get out of those situations and find a better life. And so it actually inspires a lot of my songs. Another song I have that I'm going to be recording called Don't Throw Your Smoke on Me, or it was Emily Feldman and Mo Loughran, who are two other amazing creatives in town. And she's also recording her own version, but again, similar, just about that journey and being empowered out of that.
Yeah.
And not letting that dictate my life or stop me from growing and right. being who I am today.
Yeah. It's so important, you know, to not, to catch yourself if you are falling into that sense of victimhood, not because you weren't a victim, right? Mm-hmm. Like that, whenever I do a lot of mindset coaching for people, and a lot of it revolves around this, you know, there's a lot of deep trauma for people around being a victim. And what happens is their entire mindset changes to where they feel like life is against them, essentially. And that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy in so many different ways in their lives.
Yeah.
And so you being able to look at it and say, yeah, you technically, you were a victim, but being able to look at it and go, this is going to make me even more determined to build the life I want, or to put people around me that respect me.
Yeah.
So out of this sort of transformation that you've gone through, what are your, maybe just a couple of your biggest lessons?
I would say, don't be too hard on yourself. I think that's the biggest thing, is I was always so hard on myself, and I really took it on like the things that were happening were my fault in those situations. And they weren't, like, you know, when someone's threatening you, and this person I was with in that time, he was threatening me. I had to have a restraining order against him. He was in jail for a few years because of it. And he was a really violent guy. And that's a scary thing to actually say out loud, because you have a lot of shame that comes with that. Like, who am I? Like, what kind of person am I that I got myself in that situation in the first place? Like, nobody signs up for that. They're really strong people, men and women. Eric, who I wrote this with, he had a similar experience. So we shared our like experience in that, in the song that I have coming out. And so knowing that, you know, it's not my fault in the first place, but also growing from that and not using that now as a weapon to other people and other, now in my future relationships, like, you know, I have a really amazing, healthy relationship with my husband. We just celebrated 15 years.
Nice.
And, you know, I've never brought that to the table in the relationship of like, well, I was abused, so like, you know, I can't trust you. I had to set that stuff aside. I had to learn how to trust again. And it really came through a lot of therapy, reading a lot of books on trauma, you know, and trusting myself first and believing in myself. And it is a lot of like, a lot of the meditations I do are affirmations, and the mindset that we do, that's why it's so important for me. Every day I have to do that, you know.
Recalibrate.
Yeah. I had to take some other toxic things out of my life. Like alcohol, I haven't drank in many years, and it's just not a part of my life. And it's helped me be clear-minded and be focused and, you know, get to this better place in my life that I could even do this, you know. So.
Well, good for you.
Mm-hmm.
There, you know, as you're talking about going through these things and then writing songs about them, or like channeling them into sort of creative energy. I personally have, you know, done a lot of that as well, and basically taken these sort of dark things that have happened in my past and channeled them into music or into some sort of solution or thing that I want to see in the world. So I just want to like remind people out there of the healing power of music itself.
Yeah.
Do you know Kishana a chance.
I don't know.
She's a local like soul artist, really, really incredible artist. But she does something where she like basically has workshops with women that were in abusive relationships or women that have found themselves in sort of, you know, these really dire circumstances. And we'll bring in people, you know, kind of similar to what they do for vets. I'm sure you've seen some of the outfits in town that do this with vets, where they'll bring in people who've been through you know, terrible situations in war and have a lot of trauma.
Yeah.
And the amazing healing that can happen of getting somebody to get their story out of them and actually turn it into something that seems beautiful or...
Yeah.
Or,
music is very healing. It is the writing of it, the listening to it. It actually, we're energy and music is energy. And when it interacts with us, it actually changes our like structure in our body and our mind.
Yeah.
And you can see it in, you know, for folks
cymatics.
That have. Yeah. I mean, you can see it with folks. Yeah, exactly. You can see it with folks who have memory loss. That's one thing they remember. And they hear it, and it's like, and then they can suddenly start singing the song.
Yeah.
And it's...
I volunteered for a while at an Alzheimer's center and would go in and play, you know, old tunes to the people in there. And it was, it was wild to watch how, you know, there's literally a lot of times a vacant kind of stare on a lot of these people. And then all of a sudden they would hear a tune that they knew.
Yeah.
And they're just like fully present in the moment.
Yeah.
Enjoying it. And it was really a beautiful thing. So
there's another song I just wrote for my aunt who was battling cancer. She just passed away a week ago. But I written this beautiful song with Michaela Lynn, and I was able to play that for her before she passed, which was special.
I can only imagine how special that was for her.
Yeah. And it was just about, you know, come sit beside me. And if we had all the time in the world, that I would just sit beside you and we wouldn't have to worry about anything else. I would do it. And
it's beautiful.
It's really pretty. And yeah, I may share that soon too.
Yeah.
So
awesome.
Yeah.
Well, keep doing it. You know, it's such an important thing. And those of us that are in the music business, we often, you know, have to treat it like a business, but it really is this, this spiritual thing, you know, that we're all kind of doing. And it's good to be reminded of that, I think.
So, yeah.
Thanks for the reminder there.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So let's kind of close this one out by sharing some of your music. That's cool.
Sure. Yeah. We can do that.
What do you want to share with us?
I wrote something yesterday.
Wow. Okay.
I co-wrote something. So Tabitha Meeks, who I mentioned, Tabitha and I love to write together. I have so much fun writing with her. And Joe Ginsberg. We rewrote this song called Green Light Go.
Okay.
And it's finished. It's done. It's produced. Like I was just sending the mix notes between takes here and earlier. So
okay.
I can play that for you.
Great.
If you want.
Yeah.
And we wrote this for a brief. I can't say which brief. I can't say what it was for. It's for a TV show.
Can you describe the brief?
No? It needs to be. They asked, the brief was like, it's an opening scene and it has to have a certain kind of subtle feel so it sits under the VO just right and has a particular kind of energy. And there was no specifics about the lyrics. So knowing this particular show, we just kind of took what we know about the show and what they've typically licensed and incorporated that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I can play that.
Green Light Go.
Green Light Go.
Here we go. Thanks, Heather Cook. It's great to have you on.
Thank you for having me. This was great being here.
Green light glow. I've been
Thanks for listening to Helping Our Music Industry Evolve. If you enjoyed the episode, be sure to share it with a homie. If you want weekly strategies delivered to your inbox, be sure to subscribe to my newsletter at homie.news. And if you want to grow with a community of music industry professionals, become a member at homeformusic.org. Peace.